Forensic DNA work and ancestry search sites are unraveling crime mysteries. Sacramento County's district attorney calls it the most important prosecution tool there is. On Insight, the DA talks about this work and where it might lead. The East Area Rapist case has prompted similar work on cases across the country. A new multimedia exhibit opening this evening in Davis presents personal stories of being forced out of the U.S. More about the project titled Humanizing Deportation. In our second half hour, terrific films included in the one-day French Film Festival. That's in Sacramento this weekend. And later, live music in the studio as Matea Overstreet and Victoria Boyington preview a Saturday event in Lodi. I'm Beth Ruriak. That's today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruriak. So a story that's published in the New York Times says that within 2 or 3 years, 90% of Americans of European descent will be identifiable from their DNA. And that means that on some level, the genealogical database and DNA bank worldwide will have been able to track 90% of white Americans. With that in mind, District Attorney Anne Marie Schubert became someone to talk to. She says DNA technology is the silent witness to the truth. Many of you know that forensic DNA work by her task force led to the arrest in May of the Sacramento man believed to be the East Area Rapist, and then the NorCal rape suspect Roy Charles Waller, who was arrested last month, also through DNA detective work. DA Anne Marie Schubert is in the studio. There are many, many topics we could talk about. I do want to focus today's conversation on DNA prosecution because there's so much to it, and it seems that the field is exploding right now. So, Anne Marie, thanks for coming
in. Thanks for having me here.
The outside sense of it is that this is, to some degree, a brand new field and that it is all of a sudden reaching in ways that were never possible before in prosecution. But that's not necessarily so, is it?
Well, DNA in the courtroom has been around probably since the late 80s. My first experience was in the early 90s in a courtroom. So the forensic DNA has been around for a long time, but it's also, it's evolved to the point, the science itself, obviously with genetic genealogy, as I call it, law enforcement genetic genealogy. Now we know, in my opinion, that it's going to revolutionize, it already has, the ability to solve violent crime.
Was the game-changing factor these ancestry sites, the fact that so many different companies became dedicated to gathering databanks and expanding databanks of DNA?
Well, expanding genealogy databanks. So in California, we have, the DOJ has a DNA databank, which is comprised of convicted offenders and those arrested for felony crimes. And that has revolutionized crime fighting as well, since, because that in 2004, we passed the DNA databank law that expanded it greatly. So we have had tremendous success through that databank, but now we're adding another layer, which is genealogy.
Would you give some context to what changed after Prop 69 in 2004?
Sure. So in 2004, California voters overwhelmingly supported Prop 69 and passed it, which greatly expanded who we collect DNA from. Convicted offenders, felony arrestees, some misdemeanor crimes. And before 69 was passed, if my memory is correct, the convicted offender databank had solved about 1,200 crimes, which, you know, is a good number because maybe they wouldn't have been solved. But since that time, they've solved over 65,000 cases, something 60,000 plus, or they've gotten what we call hits on, or, you know, link cases together. But it's unbelievable how successful it's been. In many of those cases, you know, but for that DNA databank, we would never have solved those crimes.
That word hits is used a lot right in this kind of a conversation. What does a hit mean?
A hit means that, so let's say hypothetically somebody burglarizes a house today and leaves their DNA behind. They cut their hand on a window. Law enforcement collects that suspect, or what we call unknown profile. They test it, get a DNA profile using forensic DNA. And then when somebody's convicted of a crime or arrested on a felony, their DNA is collected, the laboratory, DOJ, tests it and develops a profile. And then every week, the Department of Justice searches to see if there's any profile of an offender that matches an unknown, you know, a suspect case. And, you know, every week there's hits made. That's what we call a hit. So, can be a case-to-case hit, or it can be an offender-to-case
hit. How conclusive is a hit to you in DNA evidence?
Well, I mean, it's all based on statistics, but, you know, no two people, unless they're identical twins, have the matching DNA. So we have technology now where the kits that are being used are so definitive that really you're not going to find anybody else that matches that. So it's used every day in a courtroom across this country, and we get convictions all the time. I mean, it's very reliable science.
After the arrest of the man believed to be the East Area Rapist, there was discussion about how there was a link to someone in Oregon, that there was a possible DNA trail. Can you explain what happened there? And I think the understanding of how to get to the specific match is really critical.
I don't want to get too much into specifics of that case because it's pending. What I would say is that was a different kind of DNA search that had to do with what's called YSTR. So I don't really want to comment too much because it is pending, but it wasn't that trail, as some people have said, to Oregon, was not based upon a genealogy site that was used as we did for, like, for instance, the NorCal rapist.
So we have the East Area Rapist and the NorCal Rapist as these two very high profile cases. Were they similar in how the DNA forensics was used, or is the process different case to case?
Well, it's similar in the sense of genetic genealogy, and that's was utilized in both cases. The difference, you know, every case is different in the sense of you don't know who's in these genealogy trees, as I would say. So as I say, the quote tree building, which is the law enforcement piece of it, is critical to being able to identify that someone that may be the suspect or the person of interest. So what's different, I would say, is and I think I've said this publicly, is in the East Area Rapist Golden State Killer, it was enormous amount of work involved in the tree building, you know, because of many branches and things like that. In the NorCal Rapist case, again, it was the same process, but it was, as I've said, I think publicly, it was, I would say, record setting in terms of how quickly they were able to find the person of interest.
Can you say to what degree this has sparked an expansion of trying to link cold cases or connect cases to these two particular suspects?
Well, I think there's no question across this country that, in perhaps this world, that law enforcement, prosecutors have realized the power of this new kind of technique. I mean, since the time of the Golden State Killer arrest, there's probably been at least a dozen cases across this country. Some are really, I mean, when you look at, they're almost all murders. There's one in Fort Wayne, Indiana, an 8-year-old child who was raped and murdered that was resulted in arrest. There's ones across everywhere. You can look them all up. Washington. But I absolutely, and part of it is just teaching other folks how this works, because it's not necessarily simple. And that's part of one of my missions, and I'm sure the missions of folks that understand it, is to make sure we educate our law enforcement partners, make sure that we follow good practices. You know, we're not doing this on all kinds of cases. It's not going to be, you know, a guy that breaks into a car and steals something. It's going to be on violent crime, because you've got to balance, you know, public safety with, you know, that argument of privacy. And so, you know, the Department of Justice has had what we call a familial search policy for 10 years. So they have done familial searches through the DNA databank that DOJ has, and it has, in fact, resulted in some arrests and convictions. It's a similar concept. It just is using genealogy sites instead of the convicted offender site. But we want to have best practices, and we're trying to make sure that we follow the policies that we followed with a familial search for DOJ, meaning that it's got to be, you've pretty much exhausted your leads. It's a violent crime, you know, a rape or a murder. And so I think by us developing those practices, people understand that we're not just going out there, you know, willy-nilly trying to round up people.
So there is a prioritizing mm-hmm. of when to implement this type of technology or technique and, right. and when not to. Do you foresee a time when it's more standard and the process is faster?
I think as these genealogy sites grow, you may get quicker results. But it's all dependent on how they grow. And one thing we do know about these genealogy sites is that it's primarily whites that put their DNA into these genealogy sites. So it's a valuable tool that is what we call an investigative lead. You know, my attitude is that we're going to use whatever lawful sources we can, whether it's the DOJ familial search policy, whether it's just your traditional law enforcement investigation. But if you have DNA, you know, we have this tool available, we're going to use it.
On the flip side, because of the use in law enforcement, for example, are you hearing about limitations or desires for sites to limit more than they had in the past or require different disclosures in who's searching?
Well, I think the privacy argument or the conversation is going on. I mean, just last week, a study came out of Baylor Medical School where they actually, since the time of the East Area Rapist arrest, they did a study of, a survey of like 1,500 people. You know, what's your opinion about using genealogy, law enforcement using genealogy? And when it came to violent crime, it's supporting over 90% of the public supports it. So, you know, again, I think it's a matter of having best practices and doing it in a meaningful, methodical way.
I'm talking with Sacramento County District Attorney Anne Marie Schubert, and we're discussing DNA technology and the forensics work, in particular in prosecution. But it's important to say it's not only for prosecution. DNA
Absolutely.
Evidence has been important for the Innocence Project
Yes.
and the process of exoneration as well.
No question about it. I mean, in a lot of these cases, you hear about the arrest, but you may never hear about the people that were eliminated that law enforcement sent in a sample on. The other thing that I think is important is it can also be used for missing persons in identifying the remains of individuals that have never been able to be identified.
So explain to what degree that work is going on.
Our coroner's office has cases that, you know, they worked very, very hard to try to figure out who is this person that they've, you know, recovered the remains of. And it's just another area where we are confident that through genetic genealogy, you're going to be able to find out who that person is. And to me, the most important piece of all this is that we owe it to these victims, we owe it to these families. And imagine the relief a family member might have in knowing that their missing loved one has now been identified. It's a tremendous tool that I think we have the ability now to bring some answers to folks.
Your office launched a podcast this week, Justice Journal, which I believe is based on a newsletter that's been
Yes.
coming out of the office
Right.
since 2017. And this first episode does focus on DNA technology. You talk about going back to the 1990s when there was the case of serial rapist Scott Allen Wright. You
Right.
were a deputy district attorney in Solano County.
Right.
And one of the words that you use in describing it back then is that you thought it was underutilized. So what did you see back then in terms of the potential?
Well, I mean, I've said this and I mean it. I believe it's the greatest tool ever given to law enforcement to find the truth, whatever that truth is, exoneration, identification. But it's also, it's the marriage of law enforcement with science. And so, you know, it requires prosecutors, law enforcement to understand the technology and how it works and what it can and what it cannot do. And so that's where my first involvement was in the mid-90s, and then I started teaching cold cases. And I think it's really become much more powerful in the last 20-plus years.
When you opened the cold case unit here in Sacramento County, when you were given the green light for that, there was the case of a murdered teenager mm-hmm. that you worked on, Ollie
right.
George,
right.
and that was a solved case. I don't know if that involved DNA technology.
It was solved 100% because of DNA.
So can you describe what was happening then in 2001 with DNA technology? I think it was like DNA fingerprinting or something it was being called,
right.
and how sophisticated we've gotten now.
Well, the science has evolved in the sense of the kits that are used have gotten more and more efficient, proficient, I guess you can say. Back in 2001 or two, when that case was solved, I guess you can say, it was one of the very first cases that was solved. And she had gone missing, in 76. And then we asked our laboratory to do more testing on it, and then it was uploaded to the DNA databank, and then it identified this guy, Dennis Nelson, who actually was a person of interest at the time, but there was not sufficient evidence at the time to do anything. And so he was actually in prison in Folsom. I remember when the hit came in, I went and looked up these old 3x5 cards, and I'm like, oh, my God, I think he's getting out of prison soon. And in fact, he was supposed to get out within a month. And so it was, I guess you can say, serendipity that the case had been solved. And so he was then prosecuted by another prosecutor in our office, and he was ultimately convicted and sent back to prison.
Since the East Area Rapist, how much have you been contacted, reached out to, asked to assist in other cities, other states? And I think there was something going on in Nevada in particular that you were able to work on in terms of changing law or expanding law.
Yeah. So when we were, you know, as I say, on our mission to try to identify the East Area Rapist, after the press conference in 2016, when the FBI offered the reward, I was contacted by a colleague, a guy named Rock Harmon, who was a very well-known DNA DA. And he said, you ought to look at the Nevada laws. And so I did. And I realized that while they had a DNA collection law, they were not applying it retroactively, meaning that there was a lot of people in their prison system that had not had their DNA collected. So the fact that we were a state next door, I thought, you know what, we should try to see if they'll change their opinion. So a bunch of DAs got together, talked to their Nevada DAs, and in fact, the AG and the Attorney General changed their opinion, and then they started collecting DNA from other folks that were in prison, and one of which was this guy named Ewing, who ultimately was identified as committing other crimes in Colorado, very, very horrific crimes.
As a citizen, if I can ask you to step out of the DA's office for a moment, do you believe in the accessibility of putting your DNA out there, of submitting to a site? Or there was a story this week about people actually posting their DNA profile in hopes of looking for family members. Right. But what's your personal feeling about that?
My personal feeling is that you know, if I was going to put my DNA in it, I haven't put it in a genealogy site, but I think the world knows now that, you know, law enforcement may use it. And even the primary one, which many people talk about, which is GEDmatch, it says right there that law enforcement may use it. And my own personal feeling is if I got a distant relative or somebody in a tree of mine that committed a violent crime, then so be it. I'm not offended by that at all. I mean, that's just the nature of my own philosophy.
Ultimately, with this evidence going into court on these two very high-profile cases, mm-hmm. East Area Rapist, Golden State Killer, and the NorCal Rapist, how certain are you of the cases going in with DNA evidence being your primary tool and piece of evidence?
Well, I mean, we don't file cases unless we believe we can prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And we filed those cases, and we're going to proceed on, and that's what we're going to do.
Well, like I said, I wanted this conversation to focus here. I know there's a lot of anticipation about news of the investigation of the Stephon Clark case. Your office does not have that case yet, and we are not there with that news.
That's right.
So I appreciate you coming in today and focusing here, and I look forward to ongoing conversations
sure.
about this.
Well, thank you for having
Thanks,
me.
Thanks, Anne-Marie. That is Sacramento County District Attorney Anne-Marie Schubert. You can find more, and we'll post a link to that article in the New York Times at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Capital Public Radio. Listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Deportation is the action of removing someone from a country, expelling that person, throwing them out, forcing the person to leave. And a new exhibit opening this evening in Davis presents more than 50 personal stories about the layers of impact of this action. The exhibit is titled Humanizing Deportation. It's sponsored by International House Davis, iHouse, it's often called. And its executive director, Regine Sahakian, is in the studio. Hi, Regine.
Hi.
Glad to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
Will you tell me more about the stories in this exhibit? Who are they from? How were they gathered?
Yes, we have a number of stories that are in the exhibition. We have 10 featured stories with portraits taken by Leopoldo Peña, who was part of the project. And the project was undertaken through the Mellon Initiative and Comparative Border Studies at UC Davis. So it's been a long standing program in terms of the substance of how people have been working with individuals who have been deported. So the work has happened in Tijuana for the most part. Those are the stories that are going to be in the exhibition. There are over 50 video works that are featured in the space, as well as 10 specific stories that are highlighted through these portraits, as well as silkscreen posters by artists from Tana. So these stories range from a former Marine who was deported, a woman who was deported and now runs a successful tamale-making business in Mexico, as well as a number of other individuals that really span age, background, experiences, but who all share this experience of having been deported, some with families here, some who are still negotiating reunification and the possibilities of return, some who have really worked on how they're reestablishing a kind of life in a space that they actually haven't been familiar with. So there's a very deep and wide range of stories that are presented in the show.
iHouse goes back to 1984, though there is a long history of international students on campus. But this project is different for iHouse, isn't it?
It is. And I'm very happy that this project came about at this time in our shift in looking at how we can really reflect the stories from our communities here. You know, Sacramento and Yolo counties are some of the most diverse in the country. We have a long history of immigration. We have one of the most significant hubs for resettlement of refugees in Sacramento as well. And there's a really very rich cultural wealth that we have that we're looking at how we can explore. So we will always be a space where international students and scholars and people gather, but we are also looking at how we can be a space to reflect on this cultural wealth and diversity that is here, to connect people through their stories and make connections with the larger world around us, and really provide a space for that, particularly noting that there is so much coming up in our headlines that people are curious about. And it seems that community spaces for discussion and exploration have been shrinking. So we're really looking at how we can be a space to explore some of the issues that are affecting all of us and all of our communities, and also just to connect with each other in a personal way. These are all very personal stories. The way that we get to know each other is so significant in terms of getting new perspectives and understanding our local and global worlds much better. And there are just a vast number of stories that have yet to be told about Sacramento, about Davis, Winters, Esparto, all of these areas that have really incredible insight into the worlds that we inhabit and live in. So we're really excited about focusing on more of those.
What's the significance of using art for the stories? What difference does that make?
Well, you know, art just sort of, it just gives a different kind of platform for people to interact with ideas that they might be hesitant to otherwise. Art can be very accessible. You know, just installing the show yesterday, many different people come through iHouse, and we've already seen different people who may not know very much about this issue or may have been hesitant to try to find out more, really asking so many questions and wanting to know more and spending time and lingering with the portraits, just seeing people representing their stories and experiences in a way that is open, that you can walk up and look at, that you can learn more about, that you can sort of spend time with on your own as well, or discuss with other people. But it gives space. I think it just gives a very rich space for people to learn more in their own time and with something that's visual that really just immediately can connect with someone.
Regine, what's your cultural background? What's some of your own history?
Well, I came to the States with my family from Baghdad when I was about 3 years old, and we ended up in Davis, and I lived there for most of my life. I'm Armenian and Assyrian, which is both, but from Baghdad, and we have been in Davis since then. I left for about 20 years. I did most of my work doing cultural organizing overseas in the States, in New York, in Detroit, and some in California, and also in Beirut, where I was living for the past 6 years before coming back to California.
What does the word home mean to you?
Home, you know, I think for most of us, it just means where the people are that you love. And that can take so many different forms. I think we all have different homes. And I think that's part of what I'm really looking forward to exploring again at iHouse. So many of us have homes, you know, here, maybe here in Davis or in Sacramento, and also feel that sense of home, you know, for me, maybe in Beirut or in Baghdad or in New York, you know, places where we have people that we love and experiences that really have been formative in who we are and how we see the world. And places that we go back to, memories that we really hold dear. So I think home can be so many different things. And what we want to do is really explore what home is for so many of us that are here in ways that aren't necessarily just specific to one place, because so many of us have ties to so many different regions and parts of the world, as well as being grounded here in this region specifically.
The Humanizing Deportation exhibit opens tonight from 6 to 8 p.m., mm-hmm. and that's an opening to the public, correct?
It is. It's open to the public, and the show will be up for another month. Tonight will be special because we have a panel discussion that will be taking place with some of the very key members of the people who have been working on the storytelling and archive, the Humanizing Deportation Archive and Storytelling Project, including Robert Irwin, who is the head of the project, Sarah Hart, who has been instrumental in putting on the exhibition, members from TANA, which is the organization that has the Silkscreen Studio, which is part of Chicano Studies at UC Davis, which is headquartered in Woodland, and also Leopoldo Peña, who did the portraits that are featured in the exhibition. So it should be a very special night, but the exhibition is open, and there are a number of public programs that are a part of it, where you can learn more about these issues and how you can get involved on a local level. There is an Immigration and World Cafe Forum. There are ally trainings. There's a number of ways that you can dig deeper into this issue and connect with different organizations that are doing significant work in this area.
The event tonight is from 6 to 8 at iHouse. We'll post a link. And then the exhibition continues through November 6th. Regine, it's been a pleasure to meet you. Thank you for coming in. I'm glad we had a chance to talk more about this.
Thank you.
That is Regine Sahakian. She is Executive Director of the International House in Davis. And this is Insight on CAP Radio. Listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. How about a one-day mini French film festival this weekend? You can see five contemporary films, including the premiere of an IMAX documentary. Sounds exciting. In the studio with me is the festival co-founder, Cécile Mouette-Downs. Bonjour.
Bonjour.
All right, I'm going to give you a disclaimer. You're a little under the weather, so coughing or sneezing is allowed.
Thank you.
This is exciting for you. There are always comedies and good dramas, but the addition of the IMAX aspect is new.
Yes, because of the because we are having the mini fest at the IMAX, we were able to get films that are a little bit more mainstream. So I would say that the mini fest is like a little Christmas present in advance for people, because it's very all the films are crowd pleasing. We have two real comedies. We have one film that won the César for Best Director, and that is actually my favorite, I think, of the lineup, called See You Up There. And we have a thriller to end the day. And we're starting with, for the first time, we're going to show on the IMAX screen a film in real IMAX. It's a space documentary. It's a 30-minute documentary. And it's it follows the space adventure of a French astronaut called Thomas Pesquet. He's very young. He's very handsome. He's a big star in France. He had while he was in the International Space Station. He was posting photo on Instagram, and he just became very, very. Very, very famous in France. He only came back last June, and he filmed himself. He filmed a visual diary, and that included 40 hours filmed in the IMAX format. And this is what we're going to show.
We have a clip. The film is titled "Through the Eyes of an Astronaut." Let's listen.
6 mois dans l'espace, ça vous marque à vie.
All right, we have dramatic music there, and a little
bit
of French.
I think it was the taking off of the rocket.
That yeah. makes sense.
So he left from Houston. He left with the NASA, and
The Mini Film Festival is this Sunday, October 14th, at the IMAX in Sacramento, and that documentary is being shown at 11:30 in the morning.
Yes.
At 12:30 is a film titled Return of the Hero, and I want to jump to the film shown at 2:35, which is See You Up There. Will you talk about that?
Yes. So See You Up There. That's my favorite of the day. It's both an epic film about World War One. Taking place during and after World War One. It's very spectacular, and it's also a dark comedy, very surrealist. It's directed by Albert Dupontel. People who attend the festival know him, and he's always doing things that are very extravagant and very, very different. So this film is like no others. It's absolutely beautiful. It's surrealist, and it's based on a novel that won the major novel prize in France, Le Prix Goncourt, and that is absolutely gripping. It's been translated in English if people are interested to read it. This is something you will never forget, I think.
All right, let's listen to a clip and see what we can grab from it.
Pour avoir déclenché la guerre, pour ne pas l'avoir empêchée. Pour avoir aimé l'affaire, vous êtes tous condamnés à mort. Exécution!
That is from the French film See You Up There. It is a World War I dark comedy. All the films have English subtitles, correct? They're all in French this year.
Yes, except for actually the IMAX documentary that's been narrated in English.
Oh, okay.
It's too bad because the French narration is made by Marion Cotillard, and it's much better, but there's no subtitle because the screen's so big that would be too bad to have subtitle.
Okay, so the final show of the film festival at 7:45 is a thriller titled Black Tide. Let's listen to a little bit and then we'll talk about it.
Écoutez, madame, un brave garçon comme le vôtre, ça disparaît pas comme ça. Ne vous inquiétez pas.
Mon fils, il est pas comme ça. De toute façon, toutes ces histoires là, c'est pas lui.
Si vous trouvez quelque chose, ne touchez à rien.
Ça lui ressemble pas. C'est, je veux dire, même ses coups, il en a pas loupé. Il en loupe pas. Il est comme ça.
Je connais bien Danny.
Ah bon?
Ouais, je lui ai donné des cours particuliers de français l'année dernière. En tant que professeur, on devine pas mal de choses sans qu'il ait véritablement besoin de mots.
I don't know what's happening. It definitely sounds like I want popcorn.
It's a very twisted thriller. It's the cop is alcoholic. The mother of the missing teenager is obviously hiding something. And then there is a mystery neighbor who used to be the French teacher of the teenager who's very interested in the case. And the cop is wondering what he wants. And so there are several twists at the end. It's very dark. It's very gripping. It's directed by Eric Zonka. And for people who are old enough to watch French film in the 1990s, they may remember The Dream Life of Angels, which was a very international success for Eric Zonka. And he's coming back after 10 years without making films. So we're very, very excited also too. And it stars Vincent Cassel, who's been in Black Swan and other American films.
This is a one-day festival at the IMAX Theater in Sacramento. 11:30 is Through the Eyes of an Astronaut. Then at 12:30, Return of the Hero. At 2:35, See You Up There. At 5:10, C'est la Vie. And at 7:45, Black Tide. Who comes to your film festivals?
Everybody. Like you say, you don't need to speak French. You just need to want to have a good time. And at the same time, like a film like See You Up There makes you think a lot. You know, it's World War One, but it's veterans who come back from the war and, you know, nobody's taking care of them and they have to take care of themselves. So things haven't changed much. So, yeah, I think we have a wonderful program.
Thank you for rallying. Thank you for kicking your energy into high gear for us this morning.
Thank you.
Good luck in getting a brief rest before your big day on Sunday and for the IMAX documentary premiere. I think that's a really powerful addition.
It is a very powerful. Yeah. We're very excited. It was very difficult to get it, so we are crossing our finger that everything will go well.
Ah, good for you. Well, Cécile, it's always a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much, Beth.
That is Cécile Mouette-Downs. She is the co-founder of the French Film Festival. The mini festival is this Sunday. There's more at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Cap Radio. Listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. California Women's Music Festival is a nonprofit group dedicated to advancing women and girls in business, in education, and the arts. And tomorrow night in Lodi, CWM is hosting its Stronger Together Fest event. It's at Idle Beer Works in Lodi. We'll talk more about that event in a moment. But in the studio with me is California Women's Music Festival founder Victoria Boyington. I think you've been here from the very beginnings, haven't you, Victoria?
Yeah,
when you
I
were
have.
First pitching the idea of wanting to have this festival. Well, congratulations and welcome back. Singer-songwriter Matea Overstreet is with us, and she'll be performing tomorrow night and performing for us in the studio. Hi, Matea.
Hi.
Glad to have you
here.
Thank
you. It's my pleasure.
Had you heard about the Women's Festival? And if so, what had you heard about it?
You know, me and Victoria have been friends for quite some time now, and so I've kind of been in the intermixing of artists that she's been pursuing to have and as a part of her festival. So she pursued me as a participant to perform, and that's kind of how I started getting involved. And now I'm happy to be on the board of directors. So it's very exciting.
Well, you started ambitiously, Victoria, with a big festival, 1 day, 2 day, 3 days. The format of it has changed now. So these pop-up events seem to be where the niche is for you.
Definitely. I think what we were searching for is the correct demographic. And kind of where we're at, we're not seeing that demographic being met. But when I moved over to Lodi, they were super welcoming. The chamber embraced us. They made it possible for us to join. And so we're a member of the Lodi Chamber of Commerce. And we've been very happy with that move. We've been doing some pop-up concerts in Sacramento, the Bay Area, in Lodi, and Mariposa. And so in those demographic areas, we've seen a higher attendance rate.
Matea, you grew up in Modesto.
I did.
What was around you, encouraging you in music and helping to point you in a certain direction?
As a young performer, I had to really work my way into doing independent music and live music. I was mainly participating in like community theater, which I felt like limited me creatively. And once I started songwriting, I found it to be pretty challenging in Modesto to find places that would allow young people to perform in their venues. However, we've definitely come a long way in the last 5 years or so in our local community in terms of having so many different live music venues and so many different opportunities for young people. And as a result, there's so much more young talent coming out and realizing that there's a place for them. And so I think it's just all around promoting the creativity and the art culture in Modesto.
You started when you were 12 playing guitar?
Started playing guitar at 12, yeah. Yes. I was a singer my whole life, and I just wanted to be able to perform. I loved people, and I loved being on stage, and I wanted to have something that I could do on my own, and started playing guitar so that I could sing for people pretty much, and now it's just become a part of the gig, a part of the brand. And
now that you're a very old 20-something, right?
Yeah, it's been about 7 years that I've been working my way through the music scene and trying to get more exposure and come up in the social media world and things like that.
So. Well, we're standing by because our technical engineer is adjusting so that you can perform live. And I think I got the thumbs up. So are
Perfect.
You ready to go, Matea?
Awesome.
So this is Matea Overstreet. She's performing live in our studio. And you can hear her tomorrow night at a California Women's Music Festival event at Idle Beer Works in Lodi.
This voice I'll follow to where you are, if only things would change at all. Truth begins with sorrow, and I'm thinking it through while I keep looking forward. The expression of my feelings seemed to be possessed by your previous misinterpretation. And this miscommunication isn't intentional. I just wanna feel what I did before. When was the last time we had a conversation where I wasn't trying to make it right? No, no, no. I'd rather fail at honesty if you deny me my integrity as a conscious human being. Oh, what is it this time? I've been in this place with you since the day that you told me to leave. And if we took it slow, I know better than to give my whole world to you. I'll recommend you step aside, oh, while I take back what's mine. While I take back what's mine. Na da 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 da. Ooh, oh mine. Yeah, yeah, mine.
Matea Overstreet, and her original EP, Shallow, was released in June of this year. The first EP, Bad Seed EP, was released last June. Last year also, Matea was honored by the Modesto Area Music Association with their award for Singer-Songwriter of the Year.
Yes, I was. Thank you.
What do you want to do with your music? Your voice and your performing is absolutely beautiful, and I know that you have goals beyond this area.
Yes, definitely, but you know, that's not to say that I value the intimacy of local communities and local music scenes. I love that intimacy, and I love the connections that I make on a personal level with the people that listen to my music. I don't know if that's something I'm ever going to be willing to give up. You know, I love being independent. Mm-hmm. However, yes, like I'm always looking to reach new audiences and to get new ears and plant new seeds. It's just a matter of having the opportunities like this and having the content and the creativity and the hustle and the work ethic. And so those are all things that I really try to hone in on, you know. Being a 20-something or something or other, you know, it seems like there's endless opportunities. And so all you have to do is really, like, choose, you know, if you believe in yourself. And I feel like I do believe in myself at this point in my life. Mm. You just really have to just choose what you want. And, you know, I want a lot of things, but eventually I'm going to choose something. But I'm kind of just living it up right now.
Victoria, I know it matters to you that a musician has a message. And you have especially surrounded yourself with musicians that have messages for young girls. Mm-hmm. So what's happening in tomorrow night's event? And what are you working toward in these benefit events?
Well, we've been definitely wanting to integrate not just music, but art, and bring in vendors and artists from all different ages and ranges. So we have a young girl that's going to be playing tomorrow that's she's 16. And I mean, it's just amazing to watch people, you know, blossom. And it's nice to see that the older musicians that are seasoned are welcoming to those musicians and help to build them up. I just want really this event to help to grow, you know, the women of our future, because I think it's really important that we're building up ladies that can stand up to the challenges that we see every day in our world. And, you know, we need those leaders.
Stronger Together Fest is at Idle Beer Works in Lodi tomorrow night from 4 to 10. So it's October 13th. This is an all-ages event, isn't it?
Yes, that's part of why I chose Idle Beer Works, because they were very open to having all ages there. We're also going to have an art class for young kids that's going to be put on by Black Hearts Market. And I'm excited for that.
It seems, Matea, that even though you're still a young person yourself, that you've already taken on that mentoring role, and that you are willing and wanting to work with younger musicians.
Oh, absolutely. Having started out being so young and knowing that I wanted to be on the same level as the working musicians in my community, I feel like it's my responsibility, because I remember being, you know, 16, 17 and having these goals and ideas. And really
paying
not,
gigs at that age, too.
Just being able to know my way around, you know, negotiating contracts and things like that, things that kids probably don't think about, but, you know, they have these ideas and they have, you know, visions that sometimes aren't being supported by, you know, their peer group. Sometimes you have to really, like, take a risk and go out on a whim to go for your dream. And I definitely feel like it's my responsibility to reach out to young people, because I was there. And not a lot of people can say that they were there at that age really trying to make things happen. And so I feel like I have tools and I have tips for all artists, but especially young artists.
So tell me about the Business Seed Grant.
Oh, that is a grant that hopefully one day we will be able to actually open up to the public. My whole idea behind that was to help women businesses who would like to, you know, like the extra assistance on the startup fees that go along with creating a business. Because really, honestly, I didn't have a lot of help with my declaring the nonprofit status piece of this. Mm-hmm. And that would have been really a great blessing to have had that kind of assistance. So that is what we see happening with the Business Seed Grant in the future. Hopefully our July festival, because we're slated to have our actual festival in July of this coming year, hopefully we will be able to raise the money that we need in order to fund that piece, that grant. I would love to see that happen.
Well, I know you will be back before July to talk with us about that. And you just keep going, because you have been a mover shaker, Victoria. And
Thank you.
It's fun to see what you come up with next. I think I'm going to close out the show so we can hear more music. Are you game for that, Matea?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
It's really lovely to meet you and to have your voice fill our studio.
Awesome. I can't wait to come back.
Continued success. I'm looking forward to that full-length album, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
Me too.
Me three.
This is Matea Overstreet, and this is Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend, and let's close out the show with more live music in our studio. Thank you.
We should be getting somewhere by now. I can't get over myself. My bad for dragging you along. I think I took it too far. Don't take it personal. Cause you say how you feel, so I gotta be real with you. Oh, cause it's inevitable. The way I invaded your soul. And I'm capable of taking everything you own. So don't lose control if I'm taking a hold. Cause I'm wrecking your home. Yeah, just keep me locked up in a friend zone. I've been trying to let it go. I led you on some difficult road. Keeping you full up on a pedestal. I knew it wouldn't be long before we overflow. I'm just saying, you got some thinking to undergo. Don't make me say that I told you so. I didn't say I told you so. If you made me say I told you so, I swear it wasn't personal. And I'm capable of taking everything you own. So don't lose control if I'm taking a hold. Cause I'm not wrecking your home. Just keep me locked up in the friend zone. Don't take it personal. I'm not wrecking your home. I got you locked up in the friend zone. Whoa, oh, whoa, oh. Just keep me locked up in the. Keep me locked, just keep me locked up in the. Keep me locked, just keep me locked up in the friend zone. Oh, yeah.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.